isolation from Western Europe much sooner would become a matter of debate for years. Europe's most important economy was, of course, also unrepresented, having not yet been permitted by the occupying powers to create a government to represent it. Western Germany would, however, be an object of intense discussion over the coming weeks. The day the conference opened, Clay cabled Washington from Berlin, saying that an important agreement had been reached with Britain to boost industrial output in the German buy zone. When Bideau was told, he was adamant that the news be kept quiet. Its announcement at the conference, he warned Caffery, would doom it. There would, he said, then be no Europe. Whether the German problem was one of its neighbors' security, which was the French position, or their prosperity, the Benelux position, seemed unresolvable. France was determined to keep German industrial output down in the service of buttressing national defense, the Benelux to rev it up in the service of boosting trade. In this clash, the Benelux seemed to have the powerful support of the United States. With the Soviets out of the picture, though, the main political hurdle was France. The State Department needed, therefore, in Kennan's words, to place squarely before the French the choice between a rise in German production or no European recovery financed by the U.S. Caffery, in mocking reference to the Morgenthau Plan, cabled Marshall on July 20th that France had still not abandoned outwardly its pastoral approach to the German problem, and was insisting on pulling out Germany's heavy industrial teeth. Within the administration, however, the battles over the role of Germany in the recovery plan were no less heated than those between France and the State Department. With the War Department demanding more German output, and France refusing to countenance any plan premised on it, the State Department had to mediate between two vital competing American objectives, creating a Germany that could stand on its feet economically, and securing French cooperation in the creation of an integrated Western Europe. The result was an acrimonious three-way transatlantic standoff among two cabinet departments and France. Clay insisted that the United States could not place Germany in a vacuum while we solve world problems, as if it did not exist. Clay's tendency in Marshall's eyes was to do the reverse. 2 years have convinced me that we cannot have a common German policy with the French, he said bitterly. Bideau vowed that he would accept no plan that gave priority to the reconstruction of Germany over the reconstruction of France. Both Clay and Bideau threatened to resign. Clay if the French were allowed to influence German production, and Bideau if the State Department refused to renounce plans to boost it. Clay was telling Marshall he needed to break with the French agenda to save Germany and Europe. We must proceed vigorously with the revival of the German economy. If we are to save Germany from chaos and communism, and a communistic Germany is almost certain to result in a communistic Europe. Bideau was telling him he needed to break with the German agenda to save France and Europe. The French government will continue to insist that this will result, Clay said disparagingly, and no one can prove otherwise except by the test. Will Clayton argue that France's interests should be divided into legitimate and illegitimate, with the latter being ignored completely? He defined legitimate interests as military security and decreasing the economic dependency of France on Germany. But such logical quarantining was useless. Any French objection to American action in Germany could be shoehorned into one or both of these formulations. French obstruction, therefore, constrained the Marshall strategy for reviving Germany. The central plank of France's post-war reconstructionist policy was the Monnet Plan, a five-year economic modernization program premised on a massive increase in steel production that would turn the country into an industrial and export powerhouse at Germany's expense. The program doubled as a security police, since a Germany that could not produce steel could not field an army threatening to France. With the aim of military security, explained a French Foreign Office official to his American counterpart in 1946, we prefer to increase French steel production and output to the detriment of the Ruhr. Yet to put the plan into action would require huge imports of German coal and coke, and thus dependence on unlikely German collaboration in its own deindustrialization. The Monnet Plan therefore relied on French control of the German Ruhr area, Rhineland and Saarland, or at least a measure of such control through schemes aimed at internationalizing them. Here French interests clashed with those of the Benelux, which saw a robust German recovery as essential for generating the industrial and consumer demand for its exports. The three nations therefore demanded immediate action to boost Germany's coal and industrial output, and an end to misguided Allied meddling in German internal economic policy. Italy, equally export-dependent and lacking France's security concerns, backed them. Norway did as well, albeit with protections for its fish and ships. Caffery was unperturbed by the French position. In spite of relentless communist propaganda against the Marshall Plan, eight times as many French believed their government was right to participate in the American aid discussions, 64%, as believed it was wrong, 8%. Caffery told Marshall that the French plan would remain publicly wedded to a modified version of the Morgenthau plan. Bideau, he said, had hinted as much on several occasions. He merely warned Caffery not to force France to do so at the point of a gun. It would only boost the communists. This was Caffery at his best, playing the long game, shunning flashy diplomacy or bullying. Guarded, measured, he liked to keep matters the way he kept his swept-back iron-gray hair, undisturbed. With French policy headed in the right direction, he was determined to give Bideau space to maneuver and to keep pride and egos at bay. Asked by a reporter to describe his approach to diplomacy, Caffery said, "Getting things done, that's about all that amounts to." Over at the State Department, Office of European Affairs official H. Freeman Matthews concluded it was time to force Clay to view our operations and policies in Germany in light of our overall interests in Europe. Clayton assistant James Stilwell blasted Clay for his obsession with German economic self-sufficiency ideas, when the main objective of our occupation policy must be to direct the German economy so it will be able to play its rightful share in the Marshall Plan. Lovett appealed to the top War Department officials to keep in mind the concept of Western Europe rather than the individual countries. As for the three Western zones of Germany, they should be regarded not as part of Germany, but as part of Western Europe. Marshall tried to contain the War Department revolt by agreeing on July 28th to a 7-point written understanding with Truman's new Secretary of War, Kenneth Royal, prohibiting any third country, that is, France, from participating in bi-zonal decisions on German industry. But after heading to Berlin to brief Clay on the treaty with State, Royal fueled the crisis by disclaiming publicly the existence of any agreement by the War Department to consult with France over plans to raise the level of industry in Western Germany. An enraged Bideau accused the State Department of duplicity. As Lovett in Washington then tried unsuccessfully to calm French Ambassador Henri Bonnet by suggesting, falsely, that Royal was misquoted, Clayton tried to keep the Paris talks in a holding pattern. Marshall determined he had to change course to save the talks. Consultations with the French over Germany, he told Royal at a cabinet meeting on August 8th, would begin in London immediately. The treaty with Clay was null and void. In Berlin, Ambassador Murphy feared the fallout of a Clay resignation. "He may feel obliged to make certain public statements of his views and disagreements," he warned Marshall, and no one at State wanted a loose cannon like Clay rolling around the deck in a diplomatic storm. But Marshall would have been happy to replace Clay with Bedell Smith, a close friend and State Department man. Moving Smith would put the administration's German policy where it belonged, subordinate to America's interests in Europe as a whole. Royal promised Marshall to give Clay orders and drop further discussions. Clay backed off the resignation threat, but still had to be coaxed to London for critical talks with the French and British on Germany. He objected in principle to accepting any French say over German production levels, and in protocol at being subordinate to the dapper Douglas, his former financial advisor on Germany, now ambassador in London. "Whenever we go into a conference on Germany," lamented a State Department official, "we first have to negotiate a treaty with General Clay." On August 14th, Clayton and his colleagues reached a breakthrough agreement with the French and the British to create an international board comprised of representatives of the UK, US, France, Benelux, and Germany, with power to allocate Ruhr output of coal, coke, and steel between German internal consumption and exports. This vague new American commitment to internationalizing the Ruhr would acquire greater significance in the coming years, as French policy groped for means of accommodating German reconstruction in a manner consistent with French concerns. The first important offshoot would be the Schuman Plan of 1950, the French Foreign Minister's scheme devised by Monet for French and West German steel and coal production to be placed under a single authority. This would form the basis of a wider European effort in 1952, with the addition of Italy and Benelux in the form of the European Coal and Steel Community and the European Economic Community, the Common Market, in 1958. The price France paid for the American concession on the Ruhr was a secret pledge, first, not to object to revised bi-zone output levels when these were made public after the Paris talks, and second, to negotiate over the merger of their occupation zone with the bi-zone. The latter would begin only after the scheduled November Council of Foreign Ministers, CFM, meeting in London, allowing the Western Allies to frame it as a response to unreasonable Soviet conditions for a quadripartite unification of Germany. Clay returned to Berlin and Bidault to Paris, each man satisfied. After a few false starts, Marshall had maneuvered masterfully. The Benelux collaboration on grand display at the conference had, for some time, been viewed with suspicion, at times hostility, in France. At Bretton Woods 3 years earlier, future Prime Minister Pierre Mendès-France insisted on a French IMF quota higher than the combined Benelux quota, just in case the latter were to create a political union and outvote them. And now, here in Paris, the Benelux were fighting to keep the Americans from financing the Monet plan. They opposed the French using Marshall funds that would allow France to modernize its industrial plants at the expense of Benelux exports, which were manufactured with older capital stock. The Benelux also took a keen interest in currency reform, which they saw as central to their export interests. The Benelux delegate on the executive committee, Dutchman H.M.H. Hirschfeld, complained about the refusal of the U.S.-UK Joint Export-Import Agency of Military Government in Germany to allow greater German trade with the rest of Europe, which owed to fear of accumulating soft currencies. He provocatively accused the British and Americans of creating a currency curtain around the country. Benelux support for a European payments union was driven in particular by Belgium's concern that its export growth was being stymied through the stultifying web of bilateral agreements that had come to control European trade since the 1930s. These aimed at balancing trade between all pairs of nations, as any deficits had to be compensated by scarce gold or dollars. Since Belgium, which had been liberated early in 1944, and became a supplier to its devastated neighbors, was running current account surpluses with the rest of Europe, its trading partners were unwilling to take more of its exports. Belgium therefore wanted dollar aid directed not to supporting its neighbors' industrial strategies, but to supporting their credit lines to prod them to import more. Other delegations were, however, hostile to this aim. The British Labour government saw no merit in altering its economic program to accommodate more imports from Belgium and objected to dollar aid being used to finance French policies that were producing runaway inflation, 50% that year, and large trade deficits. The UK interest lies not so much in tight and rather artificial obligations of convertibility to a group, arbitrarily chosen from the economic point of view of countries inside the Marshall Europe, pronounced a committee led by Treasury official Sir Richard Otto Clark, but in expanding the international use of sterling throughout the world as a whole. The State Department opposed this view, but shared British concern about financing French monetary imprudence. It was, moreover, at this point in time, at least, unwilling to ask Congress to support a European payment scheme whose alleged need would indict the new American-made IMF as a failure. The Norwegians thought the Belgian scheme nonsense, arguing that it would take many years before most European currencies could be made convertible again. This would turn out to be factually correct, though logically flawed. By August 1, the embryo of a European payments union was taking shape, with participating countries agreeing in principle to eliminate exchange controls among themselves for goods and services transactions. The aim was to make their respective currencies fully convertible within the union at fixed, realistic exchange rates, and ultimately, to make net accruals of the currencies convertible into gold or dollars. An enthusiastic Dutch delegate went further, suggesting to Clayton that the program being developed in Paris might prove to be a powerful catalytic agent in welding the Western European economies into an economic and political unit. The conference agreed to establish a committee on payments to continue study of the issue after its conclusion, and though few, if any, could have anticipated it at the time, its deliberations would ultimately lead to the creation of a successful European payments union in 1950. In spite of most European currencies remaining inconvertible until 1958, the EPU would come to play a critical role in reviving intra-European trade. Italy's obsession at the conference was labor migration, specifically the desire to export Italians as a means of reducing its legions of underemployed. But France had agreements with Italy to allow limited migration, and had no desire to go further. Britain had its own imperial arrangements for labor importation and, as in so many other areas, was uninterested in Europeanizing the matter. The delegates could therefore agree on nothing more than a follow-up labor conference in January, to be held in Rome. Little progress would be made there either. Britain brought to the conference a different set of problems. In spite of the leading roles played there by Bevan and Franks, its government was ambivalent about the enterprise. Churchill's legendary devotion to the empire notwithstanding, he was supportive of initiatives to create a United States of Europe. Yet a British interministerial committee on the Paris talks observed that Britain was not economically part of Europe. Europe accounted for only a quarter of British trade. Under the country's long-standing policy of imperial preference, it traded twice as much with the Commonwealth as it did with Europe, and moreover did so in its own currency. The recovery of continental Europe, the committee concluded, would not itself solve our problem. We depend on the rest of the world getting dollars. For Britain, being compelled to abandon its position at the center of an empire, even a fraying one, in favor of becoming a mere spoke in a European wheel, meant dishonor, disruption, and a drain on dollar reserves. At a time when nationalization of industry rather than promoting competition within and across borders was central to the labor government's plans for reviving output and lowering unemployment, dismantling trade barriers with Britain's neighbors seemed misguided. But for Marshall, the British were demanding the impossible, wanting to benefit fully from a European program, while at the same time maintaining the position of not being wholly a European country. Getting Europeans to cooperate was proving more difficult than the Americans had anticipated. The 6'3" Will Clayton, assigned the task of keeping the conference on track, did his best to stay unseen, traveling from capital to capital, using aliases in hotels, and walking miles between meetings. But as Washington's ambassador to Europe, as the New York Times called him, his presence was keenly felt wherever he went. It was not, however, always welcomed. In London, feelings were still raw over his role in the 1945 negotiations setting the terms of American post-war financial assistance, during which he demanded a hard deadline for ending trade discrimination and the monetary paraphernalia supporting it. He tangled at times roughly not only with Franks in Paris, but Sir Stafford Cripps, the Board of Trade president in Geneva, where parallel talks were underway on creating an international trade organization, ITO. Cripps took an unyielding stand over Clayton's familiar demands for an end to imperial trade preference. Clayton's mission in Europe was much less well known in his own country, where half those polled had still not even heard of the Marshall Plan. Those who had little idea what it was. It seemed like a sort of flying saucer, one State Department official wrote. Nobody knows what it looks like, how big it is, in what direction it is moving, or whether it really exists. Whatever it was, half of those polled also said they would be unwilling to pay more taxes to support it. To produce a European plan, The CEEC needed data. Lots of it. Lengthy questionnaires were distributed for completion in each national capital within 2 weeks, covering all aspects of the country's economic and financial affairs, going back to 1929 and projecting forward to the end of 1951. As national income accounting barely existed in most of the world at this point, the exercise was at times little more than educated guesswork. Or less in some cases. After a long day of deliberations, British delegate Eric Roll, preparing to head off to bed at 2 a.m., saw lights on in the Greek offices. An official there was filling out his country's questionnaire. "But this is not for you," Roll remonstrated him. "It needs to be completed in Athens."
"You don't think anybody in Athens will know anything about this?" the Greek snorted. "I will just invent the figures myself."
His nonchalance owed only partially to his country's legendary fiscal and bureaucratic deficiencies. Greece, as well as Turkey, resented having its aid tied to an American-dictated European integration agenda in which no one envisioned that it would have a role. It was not an enthusiastic participant. The State Department intended for the various national policies, plans, and requirements to be subjected to vigorous mutual scrutiny, eliminating inaccuracy, duplication, and ineffectiveness. But this was not to be. Each nation guarded its prerogatives and refrained from probing too deeply into its neighbor's affairs for fear of having the favor returned. Washington behaved little differently. The Americans running Germany approached the task of providing projections to Paris in the same way as the other governments, conceding to the conference no authority to change their policies. Upon learning of the existence of the questionnaires, the Soviets were determined to get hold of them. "The answers to the questions will provide important information for the American industrial and financial monopolies," the head of the Soviet Foreign Affairs Ministry's Economic Department, Vladimir Gerashenko, wrote to Vyshinsky in a secret memo dated August 13th. "These entities were interested in occupying such positions in the economy of these countries, from which it would be possible to impose their programs of economic development, hinder them from selling their goods, and thus position their economies at the mercy of U.S. interests." The explanation neatly highlighted the blending of ideological fixation and pragmatism underlying Soviet diplomatic analysis. To give the USSR the opportunity to judge the state of the economies of Western Europe more fully, Gerashenko concluded, it should be entrusted to Comrade Bogolyumov in Paris to try to get the questionnaires already filled out by countries. Vyshinsky underlined these words in blue pencil. Though the State Department took pains in official and public communications to stress European ownership of the planning venture, back-channel communications, for which Clayton was the point man, were vital in shaping expectations in Paris and London of what the United States would ultimately support. Clayton insisted that any request must have three critical components to have a chance of succeeding in Washington: an explanation for the man in the street as to why European recovery was not progressing in spite of large sums already made available, about $10 billion, a 3 to 4 year production program to rectify this failure, and a rough blueprint for a type of European economic federation that would be designed to eliminate the small, watertight compartments into which Europe's pre-war and present economy is divided. The French hosts had their own ideas about what the Marshall Plan should be. Monet pleaded for some form of stabilization fund to support massive imports of consumers' goods, French shortages which could not be alleviated owing to inflation and disorder in public finances. Clayton acknowledged the reality of the consumer goods problem, but insisted that inflation control required budget balancing. Hervé Alphand, Director General of Economic and Financial Affairs at the Foreign Office, sought assurance that accommodation would be made under the International Trade Organization Charter for the web of bilateral arrangements that European nations were using to balance their trade. Clayton made clear that such would be frowned upon in Washington, not least by himself, but that a customs union along the lines of that operated by the Benelux since 1944 would be most welcomed. A zealous believer that free and non-discriminatory trade made for prosperous and peaceful peoples, Clayton saw the creation of a West European customs union as an essential step in the creation of a democratic federation it could resist the Sovietization that had befallen the East. His idea of free trade, however, did not come naturally to the intended beneficiaries. When Spaak, the Belgian PM, pressed him as to how the increased production resulting from the plan would be allocated among the participating states, a polite but exasperated Clayton told him that distribution would always best be effected by elimination of trade barriers and adherence to principles of multilateralism, and not by horse trading. Progress proved painful. The French and Italians were enthusiastic supporters of a customs union, though only as a commitment in principle with details to be worked out later. The British were willing to see the concept studied, but only as a way to talk it to death. They threw up insuperable barriers to their own participation, arguing that it infringed economic sovereignty, was incompatible with Commonwealth commitments, and interfered with the special UK-US bilateral relationship, existence of which the State Department did not recognize. The Benelux were unwilling to move forward without the British as a counterweight to the French and Italians, while the Scandinavians were ready to move forward, but only amongst themselves. Franks said that the delegates were also honestly perplexed as to how the Americans expected them to produce a program of reducing intra-European trade barriers that did not violate the draft ITO charter. Clayton assured them it would be adapted to accommodate a European plan providing for a steady reduction of tariff barriers, culminating in a zero-tariff customs union. Clayton's persistence on this issue exasperated his colleagues at State, who saw his efforts as a fruitless personal crusade that would hinder achievement of far more urgent and practical goals. "We are all in agreement with you on the point that a customs union is a desirable long-run objective," Lovett cabled him in Geneva, "but to attempt to work it out now would bog Europe down in details and distract from the main effort." Clayton, Caffery, and Douglas were Marshall's boots on the ground in Paris, working to break down the statist mindset among the Europeans. Lovett, Nitze, and the planners on the new State Department Recovery Committee in Washington, in contrast, cared most about getting a shovel-ready plan requiring no leaps of faith from skeptical congressmen. Meeting with Clayton and Caffery in Paris from August 4th to 6th, Nitze nevertheless found common ground on the need to intensify American involvement. The three were angered by reports that a number of countries represented in the CEEC, or interests within them, were buying into the communist line that they were doing the United States a favor by participating in the Marshall Plan, helping it to ward off a depression. This idea needed to be scotched and American expectations set out in no uncertain terms. A timetable for tariff reduction and eventual elimination among the participating countries should, they decided, be made mandatory. Delegations should be told the quid pro quo they would provide in return for American aid, meeting targets for production, currency stabilization, and other structural reforms. Failure to reach output quotas for commodities and food would mean a cutoff of aid. Britain should be directed not only to boost its coal output, but to eliminate much of her housing program, which was an intolerable drain on steel and labor resources. This came perilously close to Molotov's charge that the Marshall Plan was indeed an American scheme to control Europe's economies. The Europeans, hoping they could satisfy their benefactor with concessions to style rather than substance, had in late July considered hiring an American public relations firm to polish the presentation for Yankee tastes. Clayton shot down the idea, telling them such advice could be obtained from the State Department on a within-the-family basis. Marshall, though, was alert to the political dangers of offering too much familial advice. "Do not," he cabled on August 11th, "make suggestions in a manner allowing us to be maneuvered into a position where they would regard us as being committed. Congress," he said, "would react against being approached on a crisis basis, as they feel they were with Greece and Turkey. They would want some say on the terms." Clayton was convinced Marshall was overreacting. "We are in no sense committed to anything," he cabled Lovett the next day. "I have been saying just these things over and over to the delegations." Spaak and others, however, would push wholly unworkable and unacceptable schemes unless the State Department steered them. John Hickerson, deputy director of the Office of European Affairs, reminded Marshall of his Harvard speech, but he pledged friendly aid in the drafting of a European program. American guidance was vital to ensure that the German economy ceases to be a financial burden to the United States, and that the production plans of the participating countries are based on the requirements of all of them collectively. Lovett, responding for Marshall, returned the frustration in a long August 14th cable, telling Clayton that it was the Europeans who were going off the track laid out in the Secretary's Harvard speech. This argument conceded without acknowledging it that the Europeans needed steering from Washington. The cable laid stress on the substance rather than the desirability of the steering. Lovett said he would not accept an itemized bill summing up prospective deficits against a background of present policies. The Europeans had to adjust themselves to certain basic changes in their international position. They had to imagine an economic future without any outside support, one in which they were obliged to sustain themselves only by the most strenuous individual and collective effort. Only then would they be entitled to define the gaps which American aid might fill. Still, he did not want Clayton threatening to withhold aid if specific policies were not adopted or production targets not met. This could backfire if it worsened political tensions in these countries. Kennan stressed the importance of U.S. drafting assistance on the grounds of timing. It was a matter of vital national interest that Congress act on an aid program before the end of the year. France had, in July, banned all dollar purchases other than for food and fuel. Britain and Italy were expected to follow suit with severe import restrictions. One country after another would then cut imports to offset falling exports. If the United States did not create a trend in the opposite direction, it might find itself confronted with something far more serious than the present European situation. Another depression could befall the world, creating further opportunity for Soviet adventurism. Clayton agreed. He worried that progress on the report's drafting might still come to naught without interim funds from Washington. On August 6th, he suggested to Marshall that a special session of Congress might be needed to effect this. Britain, France, and Italy were, he said, in critical condition. They were running short of food. Without aid this year, they might so deteriorate economically, socially, and politically that U.S. objectives in Western Europe and elsewhere may become unattainable. Britain, having made its currency convertible on July 15th in accordance with the 1945 American Loan Agreement, was losing roughly $100 million a week and would run out of dollars and gold within months. An imminent devaluation of the pound seemed certain, obliging Britain to slash imports and abandon yet more of its imperial commitments. The country's position, Kennan said, was dire. It was still over a year away from achieving a level balance of payments, and it had no means of financing the gap. This meant serious vacuums in global security, some of which we might have to fill before Stalin did. This could cost far more than boosting aid to Britain now. And so policies that the United States considered fundamental just a few years prior were abandoned that summer. German pasteurization was out. Industrial resurrection was in. Denazification was slotted for early termination, even if it meant further amnesties. Allied control would be simplified, with more responsibility handed to the German people. The IMF, designed by FDR's Treasury to provide tough love to foreign debtors while protecting America against their devaluation habits, would be prodded to bail out Britain with a quick $320 million, $3.46 billion in today's money. Even Clayton's cherished currency convertibility and non-discrimination in trade were up for grabs, at least temporarily. He and his colleagues agreed to ignore British commitments to both enshrined in the 1945 loan agreement. Preventing the country's collapse now took priority. By mid-August, it was becoming clear that the CEEC was, from the State Department's perspective, failing. Instead of producing a plan for an integrated Western European economy that would be self-sustaining by 1952, it was preparing to add up the dollar deficit estimates of 16 countries, based on the standard of living each expected after 1951, and to submit the cumulative bill to Washington for payment. Without even mentioning a dollar value, Franks acknowledged to Clayton and Caffery that the anticipated requirements exceeded any possible availability and would have to be scaled down on a global basis. The committee lacked the power to order cuts to specific country estimates. Frank's defeatism set off alarms in Washington. The cracks in State Department unity over the essentials of a recovering program now widened into deep fissures. On August 22nd, a meeting on Marshall Plan was convened, attended by Kennan, Bolin, Kindleberger, and others, to agree on how to brief Lovett. The group singled out Clayton for fault. Whereas the headstrong Texan was generally aware of departmental thinking with regard to the plan, the group agreed, he held fundamental, divergent views on some aspects. These included his aversion to continuing European machinery to implement it, which Clayton saw as statist, and his insistence on a customs union for Europe, which his home front colleagues saw as an indulgent personal obsession bogging down the talks. It was also a distinction from State Department priorities. A rapid recovery in European output and a program that could mobilize Congress. The meeting decided that if Clayton could not be brought in line with the clarified position by cable, Kennan should be sent to Paris to set him straight. Though it was true that little progress was being made on the customs union, it was scapegoating Clayton to suggest this was at fault for lack of progress elsewhere. The group, not incidentally, also decided that more assertive friendly aid would be necessary to compel the Europeans to cooperate more and demand less, which was a position that Clayton had been pressing for some time. This meant intrusive American screening of the CEE committee reports, which would in turn necessitate an appreciable extension of the September 1st target date for the final report's submission. Parallel criticisms were also hurled at Clayton from elsewhere in the department over his handling of the ITO negotiations, where he was seen as being overly purist and insufficiently sensitive to the administration's larger foreign policy aims. In Clayton's view, the Marshall Plan made the ITO talks more important than ever, because without a sound permanent program of reciprocal multilateral trade, no temporary emergency program could possibly have any permanent worthwhile results. Clayton, trade official Winthrop Brown reflected critically years later, wanted to get total elimination of all the trade preferences, particularly those operated by Britain among its colonies and dominions. We civil servants knew it wouldn't be possible, but he was very hard to convince. On August 24th, Lovett sent a memo to Marshall headed, Paris talks on unified economic plan, concluding that there was none. With a week to go before it was due, the conference had thus far, Lovett explained, produced only 16 separate shopping lists, and expensive ones at that. At a price tag now estimated to be over $29 billion, or nearly 12% of that year's U.S. GDP and 84% of that year's federal spending, the combined prospective request amounted to more than twice the total aid disbursed everywhere in grants and loans by the United States since the end of the war. It was also nearly twice the $16 billion that Clayton saw as the maximum feasible. The Paris delegates were consciously, in Kennan's view, taking a Molotov approach, refusing concessions on economic sovereignty. And just as a family living apart leads a costlier existence than one living under a common roof, each of the 16 nations was inflating its recovery bill by assuming a need for self-sufficiency, wastefully duplicating production capacity. In this regard, France and Britain, the driving forces behind the conference, were also turning out to be its biggest headaches. Though the name of Jean Monnet is indelibly attached to the idea of European federation, at this stage, he was well behind Clayton. France stood committed to Monet's namesake plan for national recovery and development, which had as its centerpiece the replacement of German industrial and export dominance in Europe with its own. Britain, for its part, was wedded to an imperial rather than European trade and payments policy. Neither was buying into the Marshall vision of a unified West European economy, one that aimed at maximizing collective rather than national output, and which did so in the shortest time possible. Washington was no mere wounded bystander in this collision of national agendas. Far from being developed in a domestic political vacuum,
The Monnet Plan was a response to rational French distrust of American post-war planning. French commitments to multilateralism at Bretton Woods notwithstanding. Driven as they were, more by a desire for American dollars than a predilection for American trade theories, French officials feared that pre-war trading patterns would be re-established to the enduring disadvantage of French industry if they did not support homegrown champions. Replacing German manufacturers with French manufacturers did double duty as a security policy. The surest guarantee for the maintenance of peace, Alphand wrote earlier that year, will always consist in the limitation of German steel potential. But the American rejection at Potsdam of the Soviet proposal for international control of the Ruhr had convinced Alphand, rightly, that the Americans would place a much higher priority on European economic revival than on French reconstruction and defense needs. Thus was it made the fulcrum of French policy that revived German raw material production be directed to French rather than German industrial needs. De Gaulle's choice of the technocratic Monnet to lead the Commissariat Général au Plan obscured the political nature of its work, but its detailed production targets for coal, electricity, steel, cement, agriculture, and railways were, even for him, fig leaves. The individual figures in the plan, Monnet said, were all inaccurate and meant nothing. Still, it was left to Bidault to sell to Clayton the idea that France, supplied with coal and coke extracted from an Allied-administered Germany, could meet all of Western Europe's steel requirements. As for Britain, Attlee's government had been watching its dollar reserves plummet at a rate of $160 million a week since July 15th, the day on which the country committed monetary suicide in accordance with the terms of the 1945 American Loan Agreement. The world had been queuing up for the occasion for some time, ready to convert piles of excess sterling into dollars at a bargain price. In such circumstances, multilateralizing European trade and payments was, understandably, the last item on London's agenda. Introducing new import restrictions and exchange controls, in stark contrast, had climbed to the top. Bitterness toward America's global economic agenda was palpable. It was not surprising that the conference shunted off Clayton priorities such as currency convertibility and customs unions to special committees that would report back only after the conference had been adjourned. The British have turned out to be our problem children now, Truman wrote to his sister in August. They've decided to go bankrupt, and if they do that, it will end our prosperity and probably the world's too. Then Uncle Joe Stalin can have his way. The contrast to FDR's attitude 2 years earlier could not have been more stark. I had no idea that England was broke, he remarked to Morgenthau after a briefing on British finances in August 1944. I will go over there and make a couple of talks and take over the British Empire. Truman was not quite taking over the empire, but the United States was reaping the consequences of its liquidation. Over in Geneva, relations between Cripps and Clayton went from bad to worse. The former now declared it politically impossible for his government to take substantial action on eliminating its preferential trade arrangements, in spite of the latter conceding belatedly that sterling could remain inconvertible indefinitely. In a memo to Lovett, an angry Clayton recommended that the administration conclude a multilateral agreement without Britain if Cripps' callous disregard of British commitments persisted. What we must have, Clayton ally Claire Wilcox insisted, is a front-page headline that says, Empire Preference System Broken in Geneva. Martial aid and tariff cuts, he argued, were bargaining weapons that we may never possess again. Truman, with Marshall's and Lovett's support, rejected this approach, fearing that a public rift between London and Washington would be exploited by labor left-wingers and the Kremlin, resulting in new security problems in Greece and Italy, while undermining congressional aid support. An open breach with the UK, the U.S. Economic Affairs Counselor in London, Harry Hawkins, cabled Clayton, will hurt the Marshall Plan more than Britain's failure to give substantial elimination of preferences. Thus, what was seen by the Clayton camp in Geneva as a weapon to extract trade concessions from the British, Marshall aid, was seen back in Washington as precious leverage to be preserved for facing down the Soviets.
On August 24th, Lovett sent another cable to Caffery and Clayton, stating that the European program in its current form failed to meet the department's requirement that its economy be made self-sufficient in the shortest possible period of time. This needed to be accomplished, first and foremost, through mutual aid and cooperation. He directed that the friendly aid approach be upgraded, in essence, to one of determined parental guidance. Clayton left Geneva to join Caffery and Douglas in Paris. Kennan and Lovett Special Assistant Lieutenant Colonel Charles Bonesteel flew in from Washington. Meeting officially with the Conference Executive Committee for the very first time on August 31st, Clayton declared the results to date disappointing, and warned that if its present program were submitted to Washington, it might prejudice the success of the entire Marshall Program. From the American perspective, he explained, the program's highest objective was the speediest possible reactivation of the European economic machine and its restoration to a self-supporting basis. In the interim, the essential consumption requirements of the people would be met by the United States. This formulation would, in spite of the mind-numbing details that would come to define the Marshall Program, be the deal in a nutshell. That the United States would underwrite a basic standard of living in the participating countries to afford them the space to liberalize and integrate their economies. In essence, the State Department was tendering the largest foreign aid program in history as a social shock absorber for the largest structural adjustment program in history. Clayton told the committee that the $29.2 billion request it was contemplating was far too large. It had no prospect of finding political backing in Washington. Given that the aim of the Marshall Program was a self-supporting Western Europe, the fact that the conference anticipated a continued need for assistance at the end of the period that was as great as its present need, reflected, Clayton said, the unsatisfactory nature of the methods by which the gap was calculated and the assumptions on which it was based. Now, for the first time since the conference began, the State Department laid down terms for the program. It would have to result in a workable European economy independent of special outside aid within 4 years. It would need to demonstrate progress over that period in achieving production targets on items essential to European recovery, especially food and coal. It would have to focus on rapid reactivation of the most efficient existing productive facilities and finance any desired new long-run development projects only with funds sourced outside this program, such as through the new IBRD. A European plan would, Clayton continued, further require unanimous commitment to the progressive reduction and eventual elimination of barriers to trade within the area, in accordance with the principles of the ITO Charter. It would also involve participants mutually undertaking to stabilize their currencies and restore confidence in their monetary systems. Noteworthy was the absence of any mention of the role that adjustable exchange rates might play in facilitating a rebalancing of either European or transatlantic trade. The emphasis was entirely on maintaining proper rates of exchange. As at Bretton Woods, the Americans were determined to avoid mass competitive devaluations against the dollar, such as those in the 1930s. But even the IMF, whose American blueprint was hostile to devaluation, had just concluded in its annual report that the maintenance of present parities may impose an unduly contractionist influence and adversely affect the flow of world trade. Finally, Clayton explained, a European plan would necessitate the establishment of a new multilateral organization to monitor progress and ensure compliance with these conditions. This last condition was one which Clayton would be only too eager to water down, having been forced onto the list by the planners in Washington. Franks pushed back. It was unrealistic, he argued, to expect the European economy to recover sufficiently by 1952, such that it would not require further external assistance. As regards the UK specifically, recovery could not occur without three conditions being met: a return to complete convertibility of currencies, such that export receipts from one part of the world could be transferred to other areas to meet dollar needs, new markets opening up for export surpluses, and a rise in the prices of exports relative to those of imports, that is, an improvement in the terms of trade.
Alphonse said that Europe's viability depended on its ability to meet production and export targets, which was highly uncertain and would probably require the establishment of trade relationships with Eastern Europe. The Norwegians, backed by the Swedes, voiced strong objection to the requirement for a new aid recipient body to oversee performance, arguing that oversight could be done by existing organizations such as the UN Economic and Social Commission for Europe, ESCE. Norwegian journalist and future UN ambassador Hans Engen had told the Soviet embassy back in July that the governing Workers' Party only supported the Paris talks because Norway needed foreign exchange and feared, as a small country, the terms Washington would demand in bilateral talks. Kenyon, not surprisingly, put the Scandinavian position down to their being pathologically timorous about the Russians, whom they did not want to provoke through participation in a grouping established by Washington. 6 of the ESCE's 17 seats were controlled by the Soviet Union and its satellites. The Americans gave no ground. Kenyon put back that if a balanced position in Western Europe were unlikely by 1952, then a reconsideration of the entire exercise would be necessary. Frank's expectation that deficits will persist, he said, was based on a higher standard of living than Europe's productivity would support. The message was that Britain needed to bring its consumption into line with its production capacity, rather than its aspirations. This meant greater austerity in Britain, and not greater demands on the United States. As for Alphonse's conditions, most of them related to objectives the attainment of which primarily depends on the Europeans themselves. As regards the Scandinavian objection, he insisted that there had to be a direct correspondence between those monitoring the joint enterprise and those participating in it. No existing international organization was in a position to perform this work. Clayton pointed out that both the national requirements and production goals laid down by the conference had failed to take account of what Western Europe as a whole could support. As regards steel, for example, the conference was assuming that each of the 16 countries would produce at its maximum capacity, despite the fact that insufficient coal and coke would be available to accomplish this. The group needed, therefore, to go back and identify the most efficient plants from those available among them, without regard to national boundaries, to maximize output from scarce inputs. Clayton's demand represented precisely the sort of sovereign intrusion that the committee had deliberately avoided. Franks defended the group's work by highlighting instances in which country reports had been amended under peer pressure, but pointedly reminded Clayton that the conference's terms of reference specified that participant countries would suffer no diminution of sovereignty. A big gap thus remained between the American Federalist vision for Western Europe and Franco-British commitments to national planning. Still, the two sides agreed to plow on with the revised deadline of September 15th. The tense three-hour exchange had an air of unreality about it. The Americans were demanding of weak and embattled European governments a level of political boldness and planning precision that Kennan at least knew to be ridiculous. This conference, he wrote in a ruminative and frank memo following the meeting, dated September 4th, reflects in short all the weakness, the escapism, the paralysis of a region caught by war in the midst of serious problems of long-term adjustment and sadly torn by hardship, confusion, and outside pressure. We must not look to the people in Paris to accomplish the impossible. The conference could not and would not, he said, meet Clayton's demands. Kennan had been posturing in his chiding of Franks over British inability to commit to viability by 1952. Kennan, in fact, saw Britain's circumstances as not merely dire but near hopeless, tragic to a point that challenges description, he called them. As a body politic, Britain is seriously sick. A secret State Department report to two House committees written at the same time said the country was in grave financial crisis and no longer an equal member of the Big Three. For decades, the British Labour Party had pined for an opportunity to usher in its grand socialist vision for national revival, but had now come to power at a time when it was unrealizable. The country's traditional markets had disappeared. The national psyche had failed to adjust,
Clayton had admonished Franks to lower his expectations for the British standard of living in the coming years, but Kennan believed that Britain would face genuine hunger by winter, without immediate American assistance, well before Congress would be able to act on any elaborate multi-year plan. As for France, its wheat crop was the smallest in 132 years, its dollar reserves nearly exhausted. The conference was also dancing around the critical issue of Germany's future. The United States was as much at fault here as anyone, while wrapping European knuckles over failure to subject national policies to multinational scrutiny. Washington had thus far refused to subject its German plans to the requirements of the European plan being forged in Paris. Politically, it could not have been otherwise. French inhibitions and fear of communist criticism would alone have prevented that, Kennan said. As Bidault had warned, France had 180 communists in its National Assembly, who say that the Marshall Plan means Germany first. If they were not shown otherwise, the French government will not survive. But the end result was that all the parties in the room were inhibited by the consciousness of what seemed to them Herculean differences among the great powers over Germany, and by the consequent feeling that the necessary center of any real European planning is beyond the effective scope of their activity. That is, planning the creation of a West European economy, without knowing whether Germany was all in, all out, or something in between, was a charade. Kennan called for a clean break with the department policy of mere friendly aid in the drafting of a recovery plan. Two things now had to happen. First, states should take the best report that can emerge from the conference as no more than a basis for further discussion. They would subject it to executive branch scrutiny and then decide unilaterally what to present to Congress. Essentially, state would just tell the Europeans what they would get. Second, without solicitation from the Europeans, states should initiate immediate financial and material assistance where it was necessary. Call it Food and Fuel for Europe, or some such slogan. An emergency short-term aid program, administered by state, he wrote, would buy us time in which to deal deliberately and carefully with the long-term program. Without such immediate aid, the result, certainly in Britain, will be a catastrophe. A lesser writer might never have budged his bureaucracy from its settled plans and benchmarks, but Kennan had an ability to persuade readers that they were glimpsing hidden truths, truths that did not diminish them by highlighting errors in their thinking, but truths that the writer himself experiences in the telling, with his readers, giving them intellectual cover to adapt their views. And so, whereas Kennan did not demolish Marshall Plan shibboleths on his own, he made the demolition easier. Over the next several days, Marshall and Lovett sent cables to Europe calling for concessions to British political obstacles, a bending of policy in Germany to the needs of a European program, acceptance of an imperfect Paris report as a basis for further discussion, and creation of an emergency interim assistance program as a first element in the Marshall Plan. Lovett told Clayton and Caffery to push the conference to produce its final report, this time a report correct at least as to major policy lines by September 21st. But the Europeans chafed at what Bevan called the clumsy American intervention. It gave the impression that the work of the conference has been unsatisfactory and is now having to be done again under American pressure. Delaying the minister's receipt of the committee's report beyond the once extended deadline of September 15th would cause public dismay over a seemingly failed conference. Bidault called the intervention intolerable. The Americans, he said, needed to make concrete offers of substantial assistance before they could legitimately expect to discuss terms and conditions. Franks and his fellow executive committee members stressed that American pressure for yet deeper changes to the Paris request would be seen as a threat to national sovereignty, one that could be extremely dangerous politically, given the fear engendered by Soviet threats against the conferees, such as withholding coal from the Scandinavians. He warned that the State Department's integration agenda smacked of dirigisme, as it suggested that some control agency would plan and regulate the basic economic activity of the individual countries. The CEEC could go no further down this route without changing the conference's terms of reference and possibly losing some of its participants. The report, Franks warned, would ultimately fall short of U.S. essentials in some cases. The committee was willing to accept that certain adjustments might be made to the report after being mutually reviewed in Washington, but was unwilling to indicate publicly that the report was in any way only tentative or preliminary, as this would have serious negative